Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. It is Monday, so we always try to start off strong on Mondays. I don't know if you know this, but our basic pattern of the week is we try to start off strong on Mondays, have a good strong Tuesday, give them a big Wednesday, another good strong Thursday, and then a really big Friday. That's how we try to do it. And Friday, we had a great guest Friday, 2 hours, wonderful time we had talking about why aren't you a Catholic. The callers were wonderful. Our guest was Trent Horn. It was great. So we decided let's get a similarly good guest, maybe even a better guest for Monday. And this time we'll talk about what Catholic moral teaching do you reject? And who could we get to do it but Trent Horn? Hi, Trent.
Hello, Cy.
Nice to have you back here again.
It's good to be back. I see you got the memo also about...
look at us matching shirts.
Yeah, so look at this.
Yours look somehow smoother and nicer than mine, though. But you look very sharp, Trent Horn. I'm glad you finally dressed up to come in here. How was your weekend? Spent the whole weekend preparing for this show?
All certain amount of time during the weekend that I devote to work, apart from family time, which would be none, because one should spend their time outside of work pursuing their vocation and their responsibilities, and my family has to come first for that. And so it was a wonderful time, you know, going to Mass with the kids, having a little ice cream evening on Sunday. So,
oh, that's fun.
And now it's funny that our second child, little Thomas, is catching up to Matthew in the things that he likes. Because, you know, when you have like little babies, they go from a period of not really observing things too well. Like, they'll be happy with any little thing that's just right in front of them. Then they cross a threshold where they see you or a sibling has something good. You know, once they're, you know, 14, 15 months, suddenly it's like, no, I want that. That's the good stuff.
Yeah.
So now, you know, there was a time where I could go out and get my bowl of my sundae or a chocolate shake somewhere, and I just had, you know, one child, and they just get, you know, just a little sip.
Yeah.
But now it's like, you know, my wife would want one, and, you know, then, you know, it's just like sharing more now with two children could really, really like some more, and please, can I have some? It's like,
oh, that's so
then,
nice.
Then when you ask so nicely, what am I going to do?
Yeah, right. Well, let me tell you a little, let me give you a parenting tip. Okay. As your children get older, teach them about taxes. And that whenever you get French fries or a shake or something like that, you got to pay taxes to dad. And then you get 10% of whatever it is.
But I believe in having low taxes to encourage industriousness with my children, that when they receive more, they'll do more with the calories from their shakes to be more productive at home.
Wow, you're a real free marketeer.
Well, I worry that if I overtax them on the chocolate shakes and sundaes by taking too much, that will destroy, Cy, their incentive to want to work to get their own shakes and sundaes from me. So why would I bother being blind? Why would I do all these things when I'm just taxed to death anyways? That's the dilemma I come across.
It's not much of a dilemma when you're getting 10% of all of their fried food and sweets.
Then I have to know,
feel like a dilemma.
Do I do a flat tax or one based on their consumption rates? Because a three-year-old consumes differently than one-year-old. Home economics, very difficult,
also,
despite what my home ec teacher said.
As you have more children, as you go along, if God blesses you with more children, and we can pray that he will, okay, you're going to have a kid who just can't eat that much ice cream. You're going to want to get that kid a large every time, whatever it is, okay? I'm an experienced father. I just want you to know, right? So that's the kid where you go, you probably want a large shake, right? And then the kid gets a large shake. And 2 minutes later, I can't finish this. And then you're both a hero and you're a guy with a shake after that.
That sounds like a good movie title, a hero. Or no, that we were talking about movie trailers before the show.
Yeah.
He was a hero, a guy with a shake
yes.
on a mission.
Thank you. I like it. That's my trailer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
my parenting trailer. 888-318-7884 is our number. Maybe we're a little goofy because it's summertime around here. Maybe we're feeling a little relaxed. Are we a little too goofy there, Brandon, video guy? No? 888-318-7884. If there's a Catholic moral teaching that you do not accept, maybe you accept everything the Catholic Church teaches. I knew a woman one time Trent, she said to me, I believe everything in the Bible except the part where Jesus says the worker who gets paid the same wage at the end, that it's okay for him to get the same wage as that work at the beginning. She goes, Jesus would never have said that. I was like, how can you like... That's what she believed.
That's
like,
what's funny to me is, what is your standard for believing the Bible? If your standard is, well, I believe everything in the Bible that I agree with.
Yeah.
Well, then you don't, as to paraphrase St. Augustine, you don't believe in the Bible. Now you just believe in yourself.
Yeah. But it was weird that there was just one thing for her to me.
Well, like, that's nice.
She's like, I believe all of it. I don't believe Jesus would have said that. Wow. That's very... That's an interesting theology you have. So if you have one thing that bothers you about what the Catholic Church teaches morally, give us a call, 888-318-7884. We'd love to discuss it with you, 888-318-7884. Trent is an apologist here at Catholic Answers, speaker and debater extraordinaire. You can find some of his debates online. He's also the author of, I'm just looking at a stack of books here, I'm going to pick out three, Why We're Catholic, Our Reasons for Faith, Hope, and Love. And then let me pick out another one here. Let's go with Persuasive Pro-Life and Answering Atheism. He's the author of those books and many more. How did I do?
That is correct.
Yep. Okay.
It would be laborious to announce every book I had written before going on air or something like that. Now, with some Catholic authors...
Does laborious mean boring?
No, it would be very taxing on you. Though not as taxing as some Catholic authors... who have written something like 80 books.
Yeah.
Just imagine we have some
like
of those.
Peter Kraft.
Right, yeah, we had Peter Kraft on, who is the author of, and then 5 minutes later.
I just pick out like two books whenever I talk with Peter Kraft. I was like, "Mab," and I always pick out the one on heaven, Everything You Always Want to Know About Heaven, but were, or didn't think to ask, or I forget how the whole thing goes, but I don't know why, I just like that title, so I picked that one.
Sure.
He's written a million things. Yeah, Patrick Madrid's getting up there too. You don't mention all of Patrick Madrid's books. You just, you know. Throw a couple things in there. One time I did throw in a book in Patrick Madrid's introduction that he didn't write, just to see. I did that on the air and just to see if he would notice. And he goes, wait a minute. He noticed.
Huh?
I'm going to try that on you sometime.
Okay.
I'm going to do all your books and I'm going to throw one book in that you didn't write and see if you... He also wrote Bride's Head Revisited and see if you notice.
Well, at least you know with that, a man did write that despite the...
No, Evelyn Waugh wrote that.
Right.
You thought it was a man that wrote that?
Yeah.
It was Evelyn.
No, it was a man.
I'm just kidding.
That was one of the books I recommended in our summer reading list, actually, for Catholic Answers.
Oh, that's right. And I sent you a note and I said I love her.
There you go.
And then Todd sent me a note back with a very funny video of someone who actually, Evelyn Waugh, of course, is the author of Brideshead Revisited and a really good novel on us.
On grace. Conversion.
I was thinking of the one that he wrote about Constantine's mother, whose name is...
Helena?
Helena, yeah. He wrote a novel about Helena. Very good novel about Helena. Great Catholic novelist, but a man named Evelyn.
Mm-hmm.
Not Evelyn.
Evelyn.
You want to take a call?
Let's do that.
All right. John in Cleveland, Ohio, watching on YouTube. Thanks for watching. John, which Catholic moral teaching do you reject?
I disagree with the one on immigration. I know that the Pope is pro it, and I don't really agree with it. I believe we should have borders, and that if you come here illegally, you should deport it. And we have I think we should have closed borders. In other words, I'm pro closed borders, sort of.
Okay. Well, John, let me just say that I'm not familiar with the Pope's comments you may be referring to. I'm not familiar with Pope Francis saying that there ought to be open borders. Or that there are no borders at all between countries, because if you had that, then you really wouldn't have countries. What the Church teaches in the Catechism of the Catholic Church in paragraph 2241, I think would be helpful. This is the Church's position, because immigration is a complex and nuanced issue. Paragraph 2241 of the Catechism says, "The more prosperous nations are obliged, to the extent they are able, to welcome the foreigner in search of security and the means of livelihood which he cannot find in his country of origin." So there is an understanding of a right to migrate, but note the phrase, to the extent they are able. So this implies that countries have borders, allow people to immigrate. They may put limits on immigration if they feel like they are not able to support a certain number of people coming into their country. The next paragraph also talks about how immigrants are obliged to respect with gratitude the material and spiritual heritage of the country that receives them, to obey its laws, and to assist in carrying civic burdens. So there's not a position, the Catholic Church is not like, well, it's either open borders or nobody immigrates. The church is right there in between that, and people have different views about what's pragmatic or best. But John, I would like, before we have to go to a break, though, I'd like to ask you a question. You say closed borders. You say there's never a condition for a country to allow people to come from another country to live there, like for our country?
Yeah, I think, well, in our certain times, yeah, because we have a welfare system and we can't afford to have people coming here and just bankrupting our system. And they could cause some crimes. They do steal lots of jobs, and they could commit terrorism. And some of them, like especially from Middle Eastern countries, have different values than us. And they, you know what I'm saying?
Okay, sure. But John, do you think it would be moral to allow people enter this country who, for all purposes, seem to be law-abiding, want to work, and would contribute to the economy and help? And especially, let's say these people were fleeing something like ethnic cleansing. Like, you have someone who comes here and says, if I go back to my home country, they are going to murder me. Do you think we have a moral obligation to do our best to help that person so they don't get sent back to a country where they will be murdered?
Well, it depends. Like, the situation I think you're talking about is Syria. I mean, I would let in the Christian ones, but I wouldn't let in the Islamic ones, because Islam has a famous problem with having they have bad, I'm not saying that they're all bad, there are many nice ones, and they have even friends, but there is teaching, unfortunately, to, like, throw gays off roofs, to, like, treat women as property, mm-hmm. to try to make a whole Islamic state to kill non-believers. I mean, they have very problematic religions that don't match with the West whatsoever. Mm-hmm. We could see Europe has let in people in, and they are in big trouble with, like, they have a rape crisis.
Right. But John, do you think, though, that it's fair to say that, you know, within one, you know, we say there's one religion, there's going to be problematic elements and things like that. What about the individuals themselves? Do you remember the story of the Good Samaritan in the Bible?
No, not really. What was the Good Samaritan?
Well, the story of the Good Samaritan, Jesus told the story about there was a guy from Samaria, and the Jews really hated the people of Samaria because their values contradicted almost everything that they believed in, deep-seated values about worship, about what's right to do, what's wrong to do. So the Jews didn't like the Samaritans, these people from Samaria, said that they were essentially traitors to the Jewish race in their eyes. He told a story, you know, he said, you know, to love God, you should love your neighbor. And a guy said, well, who's my neighbor? I mean, John, do you think we should love our neighbor?
Of course we should love our neighbor, but doesn't mean I could love my neighbor. I just might not want him to go into my house, which is all about
right.
what America is.
I see what you're saying here, but the point is that, and we'll have to go to a break here in a second, Jesus told the story, and some scholars, there was a man who was beaten, left for dead, and in Jewish law, you couldn't touch that person. You would defile yourself. So there was a priest, scholar of the law. They followed the Jewish law to the code. They ignored that guy. But a Samaritan came by, and he came and helped that person. And Jesus said, you know, who loved his neighbor? And it was the Samaritan who did that. So I think what we learn from that lesson is that when we put other people within a certain identity grid, like, oh, you're not Christian, you're Muslim, and there are these problems, you know, within Islam. And there are certainly problems with Islam, absolutely related to terror, violence. There are things within the Muslim religion that have to be addressed and we have to talk about. But to place everyone who adheres to Islam within this grid so, you know, so rigidly so that we refuse to help anyone, even those who are at risk of ethnic cleansing, I think that strikes at the heart, that contradicts the heart of Christian charity in the gospel to really love our neighbor, even if there is some expense. There's always going to be some risk involved when you go out and you choose to help someone who is in trouble. But if we always just simply stay back and say, I don't want to take any risks at all, refuse to help people from anywhere else in the world because there's some small risk, then I think we may be failing in charity in that regard to truly love our neighbor. And so we have to balance that without having a disproportionate sense of risk and looking too much inwards instead of looking outwards. I think that's something to consider. But thank you for calling.
Thanks, John. Trent, talking to you about all your books, I forgot to ask you about the Council of Trent podcast. And I always feel like I have to spell it Council, C-O-U-N-S-E-L of Trent podcast. How's things going over there?
It's great. People can go to trenthornpodcast.com. They can listen to podcast episodes for free on iTunes and Google Play. And there's also bonus articles, interviews, and bonus podcasts available at trenthornpodcast.com.
Trenthornpodcast.com is where you go. And then you're doing, say, an interview. And if I'm just explain to me how it works. If I'm just a person, I'm like, oh, I'm interested in an interview. I can go listen to that interview.
Yeah.
But there might be a bonus stuff that is for those who are supporting the thing, because you want to give them a little something extra as well.
Yeah. So to help the podcast to grow and eventually branch into new content, like creating videos that explain the faith using really cool animation, that's a project I'm working on now. We rely on supporters of the podcast to be able to do that, to create short videos. I also want to create a complete course in apologetics. You could do a complete class in apologetics online, and we need supporters to help for the resources to create that. And people who subscribe to the podcast online can do that. So you can get episodes for free, iTunes, Google Play. But if you go to trenthornpodcast.com and subscribe to one of the levels, whether it's silver, gold, platinum, or silver, gold, bronze, silver, gold, or nth metal, comic book reference. And with different levels, you get different bonuses like extra podcasts, the ability to submit questions for future podcasts. You get to do live video chat sessions with me as some of them. And you can also get a free t-shirt. But if you want to learn more about that, definitely go to trenthornpodcast.com.
And if we're going to be talking about it, will you just memorize the levels? All right? So we don't have to...
I knew silver and gold were there. I just didn't know if it was bronze or platinum.
I knew nth metal was there too.
Yeah.
I'd like that.
Okay.
Nth metal is... Not pretend metal, but fictional metal
from the planet Thanagar.
Of course.
Yes.
We all know that, Trent.
Yes,
let's take a quick, very, very quick break, and we'll be right back.
Bringing you the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
It's the start of a new day for Morning Catholic Radio.
Isn't it the case that when you're stirring food in a pot, it burns less, like, because it's not just sitting there?
What about your forearms? You get some nice buff forearms when you're doing that stirring.
But let me say,
totally get this for you, Gloria. You don't need any help stirring the pot.
You know, you all make it so easy for me.
Morning Glory, Catholic from the start. Weekday mornings, 7 Eastern, on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Trent Horn is our guest. Our topic, which Catholic moral teaching do you reject? If you reject a Catholic moral teaching and would like to discuss it with us, we'd love it if you'd give us a call, 888-318-7884. That's 888-318-7884. We go now to Chase in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Watching on YouTube. Thanks for joining us on YouTube, Chase. Your question for Trent.
Hi, Si and Trent.
Hi, Chase.
Good to be. Glad to hear you. And
you too.
Thanks. my question, so I'm Catholic, and I'm asking on behalf of a friend who I had a conversation with. Mm-hmm. And their question, the question we talked about was, how do you respond to the idea that Catholic moral teaching on sin is actually teaching against natural human inclinations that are okay as long as they don't negatively impact you or someone else physically and or mentally?
Sure. I think my response would be that the Catholic teaching on sin is that we have different natural desires. I guess here's how I would respond to that. They're assuming a particular moral standard is what it sounds like, saying, well, morality is just about doing things that don't harm you or other people. That's their standard of morality. Whereas the Catholic standard of morality would include that, but it would kind of go beyond the definition of harm. Because I think when many people say that, well, just don't harm other people, they have a narrow sense of harm, which is, you know, grave bodily harm, psychological trauma, things like that. They wouldn't think, for example, that self-gratification, for example, or masturbation, they'd say, well, they wouldn't see that as harmful. They'd say, well, I just see some, you know, there's someone, they engage in an act and they feel pleasure, and then maybe they feel shame later, but that's not a big deal. It's nothing to be ashamed of. I don't see the harm there. Whereas from the Catholic moral tradition, I'd say, well, there is harm. Number one, you take something that God gave us for a very particular sacred purpose that we can know through reason is for a very important purpose, you know, the uniting of two people in the act of marital love, and turn it inwards and so degradate this special gift of the human body. And so there is harm caused there. So in one sense, I would agree with the person that, yeah, the Catholic position holds, if you to quote St. Thomas Aquinas, that God is only upset with us when we go against our own nature, when we harm ourselves. Because God, that sin is not just some kind of arbitrary set of rules God gives. That ultimately God wants us to fulfill our being, to be the people he created us for. When we follow God's will, we flourish. When we do follow the natural law written in our very own being, we flourish as human beings. We're happy. We may not be always happy at every single moment, but we flourish and grow. Whereas when we act against our nature, act against who God created us to be, we do harm ourselves, even if we don't notice it at first, or even if there isn't a lot of pain or something like that at first. So I might say to that person, you know, well, I agree with you that Catholic morality, you know, we don't want to go around harming people or ourselves, but what do we mean by harm? And that there is a greater definition for that. For example, Chase, here's a counterexample I could think of. Is it wrong for a man to sit at home, or let's say he sits at a playground, and he sits there and he fantasizes about doing unsavory things and acts of harm towards the children he sees playing there, okay? And he never acts on it. He just sits there on the bench, and he likes to think about this while the kids run and play in front of him. My question would be, is this man doing something evil? Now, if you define harm really in a limited way, you'd say, well, he's not harming anyone. What's wrong? But here, clearly, no, he is thinking evil thoughts. This is something evil. Why? Because he's not living out life as he should. He's not acting with his appropriate rational human nature that he should have, ordering his proper ends or being ordered towards very improper, violent, inhuman ends when he thinks of these things. So that might be something I'd point out, that the definition of harm in secular morality is too limited, and that Catholics, we have an agreement here, but the idea of harm is rooted in our human nature and what God created us to be. So a bit of a long answer there, but is that helpful?
Yeah, definitely. Thanks a lot.
Okay, good.
Thank you, Chase. Appreciate it. 888-318-7884, the number here. If you have a reason, or we'd love to hear the reason, but if you have a particular moral teaching that the Catholic Church offers that you reject, today is your day. We are asking you, which Catholic moral teaching do you reject? Trent Horn, our guest, and we go now to Josh somewhere here in California watching on YouTube. It's a big YouTube day today. Josh, which Catholic moral teaching do you reject?
Yes. Hi. Well, I think I kind of reject the concept of transubstantiation in the Mass. But to be more specific, like, I don't think I really understand how the Catholics view the Mass as part of the salvific, you know, plan of human lives. Like, we're somehow saved by taking Mass, and therefore engaging in that act of, I don't know, almost seems like cannibalism. And I'm trying to understand, like, how that is reconciled through Scripture as being an act of salvation.
Okay, sure. Here's how I would answer that ultimately God's plan of salvation is to free us from sins, so that we can be his adopted son or daughters, to partake of his grace, his very divine life, so that we're transformed in Christ. As Paul says in Galatians, is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives within me. So that we are then, through God's grace, his sanctifying grace, we eventually will become perfected so that we can live in heaven with God for all eternity. So Catholics believe that salvation is a process in that regard, that baptism washes away original sin, it adopts us into God's family, but the reception of God's grace is an ongoing process for us to be continually sanctified. And Jesus himself talked about that. He said in John chapter 6 that unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no life within you. And to me, I think that seems very clear what Jesus is saying, that we have to receive him in order to have that spiritual life we need in order to be saved, to receive God's life and God's grace. So what the Mass is not cannibalism, because cannibalism takes a dead human body, dismembers it, and you eat flesh and blood under the form of flesh and blood. Jesus gives us his very divine life under the form of bread and wine so that we can be spiritually nourished and fed and continually perfected so we can spend eternity with God.
We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more. Which Catholic moral teaching do you reject? With Trent Horn on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
This is Archbishop J. Michael Miller of Vancouver, Canada, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
God helps those who help themselves. Preach the gospel always. When necessary, use words. We all hear sayings like these, and we assume they come from the Bible, the saints, or famous Christian writers. Nobody can seem to place their origin, but by sheer repetition, they've acquired a halo of truth. In my new book, What the Saints Never Said, I look at over 40 of these well-known sayings and track them back to their original sources. You'll be surprised at what I found. Some are close to what was really said. Many were misattributed or twisted beyond their original meaning, and more than a few of these sayings were simply made up. I hope by setting the record straight, I can make you aware of the theological errors that can lead us away from the faith and offer you authentic quotes from scripture, saints, and scholars that will draw you closer to our faith. Get your copy of What the Saints Never Said by calling 1-888-291-8000, by visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, this is Cy Kellett. Have you ever noticed that people only use the word spectacular in an ad? Well, we have a spectacular online event going on right now. It's our store-wide summer sale, which includes savings of 10 to 25% and more in some cases on every book, tract, CD, DVD, ebook, and MP3 we carry, including all the newest resources from my good friends Tim Staple, Jimmy Akin, Trent Horn, and Carlo Broussard. With lower prices and a great summer selection, it is by far the most spectacular online Catholic summer sale. So log on now and all this month to the shop at shop.catholic.com and take advantage of our very special prices. You know it's all good stuff because it's from the people you know and trust at Catholic Answers.
I'm Tom Price, along with Gloria Purvis and our godly counsel, Father Vincent DeRosa. We'll also be talking with Nicolie Ambrose about persecuted Christians. Join us for Morning Glory, 7 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Trent Horn, our guest, the author of many things, including Why We're Catholic, What the Saints Never Said, Persuasive Pro-Life, Wuthering Heights. He's a prolific author.
That was just one I recommend. No, well, I didn't recommend Wuthering Heights. I recommended Brideshead Revisited, but still another good book.
Okay, just thought I'd throw it in and see if you noticed.
It was the other Bronte who wrote that, right? Wuthering Heights? Was it Charlotte or no? Yes.
Yeah, Charlotte Bronte wrote Wuthering Heights. The Bronte sisters.
Yeah.
For some reason, now I have the song Schuyler Sisters in my head. Do you know what that's from?
No, I do not.
That is from that play Hamilton, which I've never seen. But because of one of my children, I have heard the soundtrack about a million times. So
I haven't thanks. Seen it either. I think there's a large group of people who would like to, but I think they're going to be sold out until Kingdom Come. So
yeah, right.
What it seems like.
Right. You can get tickets after Kingdom Come.
Oh, okay. Thank
you. But that you got to wait till then, apparently.
Yeah, I guess. Okay.
Ivan or Yvonne in Canada, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Ivan, which Catholic moral teaching do you reject?
Hi. So I'm calling in regards to this document by the Vatican called The Gift of Priestly Vocation. And this document basically states that men who have deep-seated homosexual tendencies cannot become priests, as in they cannot be admitted to a seminary. And I do have issues with this since the Catholic teaching is basically, of course, that, you know, those the homosexual tendencies and, the actions are, of course, sinful, and they should live a chaste lifestyle. And since priests in the Latin Church do live a chaste lifestyle, I have an issue with that since I feel that their sexuality should be irrelevant in this situation.
Okay. Ivan, thank you for the question. That document, I don't remember when that particular document was written, but it's probably referring back to a 2005 declaration from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith on this particular question. The document is called Instruction Concerning the Criteria for the Discernment of Vocations with Regard to Persons with Homosexual Tendencies in View of Their Admission to the Seminary and to Holy Orders. And basically the reason that the CDF gives for saying not just someone with transitory feelings, but with either deep-seated homosexual tendencies or supportive of so-called gay culture is a problem of reaching affective maturity. So the idea here is that you're correct that desire for homosexual behavior in and of itself is not sinful, but the catechism does say it's intrinsically disordered. And so if this is deep-seated, then you'd have a problem with a candidate who has a deep-seated disorder within them and possibly other psychological disorders that flow from that, preventing them from being able to properly relate with men and women because of this disordered state of being. So that's the primary reason that's put forward, that you know, you've got someone here that priests have to reach an affective maturity. And so if they're unable to, if they have this block that represents a serious disorder in their ability to relate to other people, especially other men, that could be problematic. Even from a practical standpoint, I would say that priests live in community in very close quarters with one another often. And so someone with these deep-seated tendencies, this isn't reflected in the document, but I think a practical element that you could draw from it would be that just as I would not live in close community with nuns because of the natural tension that would exist between me and women, someone with deep-seated homosexual tendencies would have a difficult time in close proximity and living conditions with other men in the priesthood. So if you'd like to see more of the justification related on that, you could refer to that 2005 CDF document that I just cited.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Okay, sure.
Thank you very much. 888-318-7884, the number. If there's a particular Catholic moral teaching that you reject and you'd like to discuss it with us, we're asking you, which Catholic moral teaching do you reject today? We go now to Tim in Fredericksburg, Virginia, watching on YouTube. Tim, which Catholic moral teaching do you reject?
Well, it's not really a rejection per se. On the subject of sex outside of marriage.
Okay.
Now, generally speaking, I am on board with the church teaching that sex outside of marriage is wrong. Adultery, I believe, is wrong. Sex for money is wrong. You know, forcible sex, like rape or whatever, is wrong. Two teenagers who want to lose their virginity just for the bragging rights, you know, who aren't mature enough for a sexual relationship. Sailor comes in from sea after 6 months and goes to a brothel. That's wrong.
But
I'm talking about two mature adults, well-educated, neither one of them are married, and they choose to engage in a sexual relationship with no coercion. You know, they're in love. They want to do it. I don't have a problem with that. Now, I guess I want to get some clarification on why that would not be okay, too.
Tim, so let's try another example. Let's say two young people meet each other on an online dating app and they agree, they think each other, they're both really cool people and they just want a one night stand. And then after that, nothing else. Would you say that was wrong?
Yes, I would also say that was wrong.
Okay, so it sounds like they have to be in love. Why does that matter?
They have to have some kind of a relationship going, yeah.
Do they, okay, what if they said, well, we'll do this, but we'll probably break up and 3 months anyways at the end of the summer when we go to different schools.
I guess you could ask the what if questions forever.
But that's the thing, Tim. I'm trying to figure out what your standard is. Because if you say, well, they have to be in love, that seems like kind of a nebulous concept, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you define that?
It's like pornography. You know it when you see it.
Sure. But I guess here's what the church would say, and then you and I can talk about it a little bit. Ultimately, to see if sex is wrong, we have to ask the question, what is sex for? We have to ask, what is it for? And I would say that here's my summary based on the church teaching and natural law, what sex is for. Sex is for the expression of marital love. And what marital love is the faithful, lifelong union that includes a complete bodily union that only exists between men and women. And so to me, that makes sense on a number of levels. The one that jumps out the most is that if marital love is this lifelong, permanent, faithful bond, and sex is that expression of it, that makes sense because sex is ordered towards a permanent consequence. For example, Tim, isn't it often the case that two people, if they're in love, they might have sex, and more often than not, a child comes into existence. But so now there's something biological that ties this man and woman to the child, but nothing except feelings that tie the man and woman to each other. And that can make problems later, right?
Well, yeah, but using that logic, Adam and Eve were committing a sin because they were never married, technically.
Well, they weren't married in the sense that they went in front of a priest or anything like that, but God created them for one another, and God was a witness to them coming together.
But would you agree that marriage is really more of a social construct than anything else?
Now,
no. You know, man invented marriage. God invented sex.
Actually, I think you could possibly reverse that. I would say that God invented marriage. God gave us marriage. And sex is something that's just a natural part of our being as mammals. That, you know, that's a drive we have naturally. I think man invented many modern ideas about sex, like that it's for pleasure, that it's ultimately not that big a deal as long as everybody is consenting. So for me, though, I would go back to that. Wouldn't it make sense, though, that if sex is ordered towards something that has a lifelong consequence, like the creation of a child, and children have a right to their mothers and fathers, then wouldn't it make sense you'd want something that unites mothers and fathers, that unites men and women together, like marriage, before they come together physically to create a child? Wouldn't that at least make sense?
That would make sense, but okay, well, maybe they do plan on getting married someday. Maybe a child happens, and oh boy, looks like we're going to have to get married, and they're okay, and the marriage lasts forever. But
hopefully, but that's not necessarily ideal. And I guess I'd use this example. Which would you rather have? Let's say you get sick and you go to the hospital and you're getting ready to be operated on. And two people walk in. One guy says, hi, you know, I became a doctor, a year ago and got my license and we're ready to operate on you. And another guy says, I'm going to be a doctor in a year. Don't worry, I'll get that license in a year, but I'm still learning. I'm not technically a doctor yet, but I'll be there in a year. Well, I think most people would say, I want the one who actually is a doctor, who actually has a medical license, not the one who I hope he will be a doctor in a year. Maybe he will, maybe he won't. And I think that's the same for marriage, that ideally when a child comes into existence, they should have, at the very moment they exist, at that very first moment, they should have a mother and father who were united to one another in the bonds of marriage, that lifelong, permanent, faithful bond, so that that child can know, hey, here's mom, here's dad, and I don't have to go across town to see mom, I don't have to go across town to see dad and be divvied up on different weekends. These two have been bonded to each other before they're bonded to me. And when people do that, that provides health and welfare and well-being to the family. When they don't, we've seen sociologically what happens. Now, I'm making just essentially a pragmatic argument. There's other arguments for why sex outside of marriage is wrong. But I think the ultimate way I would boil it down to is this. We have to ask, what is sex for? If we don't answer that question, if we say it's just for the expression of love, well, why? Why should we think that among human beings? Where does that category come down to? I think we know it is, but then we don't really know why it is. But to me, if we say it's for the expression of marital love, then we understand the lifelong element, why it's only two people. Because if sex is for love, then would it be okay for a man to have his girlfriend and other girlfriend and other girlfriend, people on the side? I mean, you can love lots of friends, right? Well, yeah, but you can't love lots of spouses, lots of romantic partners. Romantic love desires exclusivity. And that really only makes sense if sex is for, romantic love is for, the communication of exclusive, lifelong, permanent marital love. And if that's the case, then we see sex outside of marriage is wrong because it communicates this powerful kind of love in a fraudulent way because you're not really married when you engage in that activity. So that might be something that I would think about. And I'd also recommend a book that's coming out from Catholic Answers soon, similar to these themes, called Inseparable. And it's a book with five contributors about the church's teaching on sexuality, the ends of sex, and how it relates to things like contraception. But thanks for calling.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks very much. You'll be able to buy that book soon in our at shop.catholic.com, which brings me to which reminds me. Right now, they got that big summer sale going on at shop.catholic.com. Almost everything, books, audios, DVDs, tracks, digital productions, it's all on sale, 10 to 25% off, some of it even more. You know what the promo code is?
I do not.
There is none. You
Whoa,
just go there and shop.
How wonderful.
And everything is marked down 10, 25, or maybe more. This includes all of your books, your CDs, DVDs, Trent. shop.catholic.com. You don't seem excited that your stuff is on sale. You just want other people's stuff to be on sale?
Well, there's so many quality products at shop.catholic.com. Who am I to judge what people will buy when they go there?
Nice use of who am I to judge.
Who am I to judge? That if you want to buy my books or something by my colleagues like Carla Broussard and Tim Staples, who am I to judge as long as you're a person of goodwill?
All right. Carla Broussard's book. Prepare the way. Yep. Overcoming obstacles to God, the gospel, and the church. For a while, I kept saying the gospels, but that doesn't actually make any sense. Like, we don't have an obstacle to the gospels.
Well, I mean, some people may feel that there are contradictions or elements in the gospels that they disagree with, or they think they can't trust the reliability of the gospels. But I think what Carlo means is the gospel, the good news about our salvation in Jesus Christ and through this church.
Amen, brother. Well, we got to take a very, very brief break. We'll be right back with more. Which Catholic moral teaching do you reject? With Trent Horn on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
Listening to your program has really touched my heart, and I just see such love and beauty, not only for Christ, but for people in general in the Catholic Church. And now I feel like I need more. I want to serve God more. I feel it so much that He's given me a gift to serve and to touch people, to love people. What would it take for me to maybe look into the priesthood?
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Trent Horn is our guest. Hey, guess who's going to be a guest on Friday?
Who is going to be a guest on Friday?
That's not a guess.
Okay, Pope Francis.
No, but almost the same initials as Pope Francis. Patrick Coffin.
You're halfway there.
P for Pope, P for Patrick. Yeah. Okay. It works. Yeah.
It gets you about halfway there.
Yeah. Patrick Coffin has been away for a while. And
I know.
He's going to come back and he's going to talk about his brand new book, The Contraception Deception, which is a follow-up to his very fine book, Conjunction Junction. No, that's not really true. It just sounds like that to me.
I never understood that phrase or its function.
I know, hooking up phrases and clauses. And here's the deal, though. Patrick Coffin is coming in. He is the predecessor host
on
this show.
I know. Don't old host meets new host.
No.
Tensions.
No.
We met many, many years ago.
But, I know, but it's like...
There's no tension. There's nothing like that. Here is the horror to me.
Okay.
Months ago, I planned to be on vacation the last 2 days of this week. And then they scheduled Patrick Coffin to come in Friday. And now it's going to look like, oh, the one time Patrick Coffin comes back, you can't even be bothered to show up.
I understand. If it's awkward and you have to escape it, Si, I understand.
That's not it.
I understand.
That's not it.
It happens to all of us sometimes. You know, we call a friend or you're going to be here and be like, Trent, I need you to call and get me out of here. Say there's some kind of emergency.
Yeah.
You know, apologetic radio emergency.
Right. Right. Sorry, Patrick Coffin. I have to run. I can't do the show. No, it's nothing like that. Okay. I would love to talk to Patrick about The Contraception Deception, the follow-up to his very fine book, Conjunction Junction, What's Your Function? But I'm going to be away.
Okay.
I'm embarrassed to say it, but I'm going to.
You'll be missing out.
I will be. But Chris Check will be here. He'll be hosting. 888-31-TRUTH is our number, 888-318-7884. If there is some moral teaching of the Catholic Church that you reject, give us a call because we're asking that question today. Which Catholic moral teaching do you reject? Trent Horn is our guest and very happy to take your call, 888-318-7884. We go now to Ray in Chester, Virginia, listening to EWTN on Sirius XM satellite radio. Ray, which Catholic moral teaching do you reject?
Well, first of all, I want to commend you for inviting people to call and disagree with you, which is very rare in Christian radio.
Oh, thank you.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So here's what I wanted to call about. Basically, Genesis 3, you have the story of God telling Adam and Eve not to do something with just one warning about dying, not mentioning anything else about the fact that they're representatives of every person that comes after, all the suffering and the sin and everything like that. So it seems a bit immoral to just have one warning, which he may not have even understood since he never saw anybody die before.
You mean Adam and Eve?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Well, here's how I would respond to that. First, Genesis chapter 3, what the Catechism teaches is that it's written in symbolic language. So it's expressing real truths about the human race and about the fall of man, but it's using symbolic language to do so. So there may not have, the transgression of our first parents may not have been literally eating a fruit on a tree that they are prohibited from eating from. Pope St. John Paul II talks about this in one of his encyclicals, and he talks about this, and I believe this is also referenced in the Catechism, that the sin of our first parents, the sin of Adam and Eve, was transgressing the boundaries that God gave them. And so if you see in Genesis 3 with that language, what the serpent is telling them is that you will become gods. You know, God told you this. God told you you would die. You know, you would know you won't die. You know, you won't die a physical death, but you will know good and evil. You will be gods. And so the idea here is that the sin that they committed was one for wanting to be able to have things on their own terms. And different church fathers and theologians have interpreted this first sin in different ways. But ultimately, it's some kind of sin of pride of Adam and Eve wanting to put themselves as being most important above and over God, to have that kind of authority that that only God alone has. And I think really this makes sense. I was actually thinking about original sin earlier, Si, because I was thinking of writing up something about the president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte.
Oh, yeah. He's giving away $1 million or something.
Yeah, if you can prove God exists, but he's really unhappy about God. He says God is really stupid because of this, because of the question of original sin, what Ray has just brought up. You know, how could God allow something like this to happen? But I think for me, what's interesting, and I was reading an essay about original sin written by a Polish philosopher, and he says it's so interesting, if the concept of original sin were so stupid, why would so many people believe in it and see, yeah, this makes sense. Even illiterate peasants, when they hear the story, they don't say, oh, I don't care. This doesn't affect me. That's unfair. I think deep down, we just all know that that's a story about all of us, that we are not the way we are supposed to be.
Right.
That I do things and I accept that I'm responsible and I shouldn't be this way. So, you know, some people, I understand that you are a certain way you wish you were, but you don't feel guilt about it. Like, some people burn very easily in the sun. They walk outside and, you know, they just they turn into a piece of bacon in 5 minutes without sunscreen. And they go, oh, I should be this way. And they feel bad about it. But they don't feel guilty.
No.
And it's something not under their control. But they wish they weren't this way.
Mm-hmm.
However, in the moral sphere, we don't treat our desire to be selfish or hurt others. We don't treat that as just a mere genetic abnormality, like having pale skin that burns easily. We don't treat that as like, oh, luck of the genetic draw. It's like, I feel bad I'm this way and I shouldn't. What is the explanation for that? Mm-hmm. It's like I received this from the moment that I was born.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's just what original sin is. So I guess that I would answer our caller, Ray, to say that when you read Genesis 3, just look at it. These are the basic truths that are coming through. The basic truths that God exists, God made the world, God made man in his image, and that man, our first parents, Adam and Eve, rejected God and fell away from him. And in doing so, they lost that special grace and relationship they had with God that would have protected them from disease, death, and things like this. And so since they lost it, they could not give it to us. Just the same as if I won the lottery, but I cheated and I had to give the money back, I couldn't give that money to my children. They're harmed because of that. That money would have helped them. But they're harmed because of something I did that affects them. But with the beauty, you say, well, it's unjust. Well, look, that's what the whole point in, and read Romans chapter 5. The point here is that, yeah, through Adam and Eve, they do something wrong, and that keeps us from inheriting God's grace. It's not passed along to us. But at the same time, when we're all united in that because of that original sin, Christ is able to redeem all of us because of that. That through one man, sin entered the world, but through one man, the world was redeemed. That's why Christ can be the new Adam to undo that. And God allows this to happen, contra President Duterte of the Philippines, not because he's stupid, but as they sing in the Exalted at Easter, Felix culpa, oh happy fault, that brought us so great a redeemer, that God allows evil because he's still able to triumph over it in an even more glorious way.
Ray, thanks very much. I might also suggest there was an interesting article, May 21st, New York Times, a secular writer writing why we need to bring back the concept of original sin.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Let's look into that.
Because the writer was like, there's clearly something wrong with us.
And people agree with that, but they always want to put the blame somewhere like, oh, evolutionary psychology, or oh, it's racist or sexist power structures. And ultimately, it goes back to sin. It goes back to us falling short of the divine image that God has made for us. And so there is a divide in the world side when you think about it, that people think either that human beings are born good and the world corrupts them, or human beings are born evil, or at least in the sense they're born corrupted. Mm-hmm. That might be a better word to choose. Some people think humans are born pure, and it's the world that corrupts them. And so what we have to do is we have to fix the world so it doesn't corrupt little innocent human beings.
Oh, very good point.
Whereas the other view, which would be the historic Christian view, is that human beings are born corrupted.
Mm-hmm.
That is why the world is corrupt. And so it is not the world that will ultimately make them restored to their proper form, but it's the grace of God. That doesn't mean we shouldn't fix the world. We should.
Yeah.
So that people can live and flourish. But when people have these two different views, so when they think that the problem is the world itself, they don't think about man. They want to change power structures. They want to change structures of inequality. And things that they call it in this way. And the cart goes before the horse. It's like we have to fix all these bad things in the world, whereas the reason things are bad in the world is because of bad things in us.
Yeah.
Fix that. You can do both, but don't neglect to primarily, we have to fix the bad things in here.
Yeah, and we end up too with the solutions to a problem that is much deeper than the solutions are able to reach. Like, oh well, if we had good education,
right? That,
good education is a very good,
right?
But it's not going to fix the world. If we say, well, you know, if people just learned science and learned reason and all that, it's not going to get. We'll still be. There's something wrong with us that goes deeper than that.
Right, and that's the problem, is that universities used to teach, you know, the science of ethics and virtue even.
Yeah.
But the problem is in the early 20th century, empirical rationalists said that, look, the only facts out there are the things you can prove scientifically. We can't prove morality scientifically. It's not a fact to teach. So suddenly now we don't teach people objective virtue in schools. Instead, we teach them to, you know, develop their own moral code, which people do to their own peril.
Yeah, because if you develop your own moral code, it has you right at the middle of it. Mm-hmm. And that is not
how can you ever be wrong?
Yeah. Again, we're going to come back and do this for a whole for one more entire hour.
One more
Trent
hour.
Horn will be with us. Where the question of that, yeah, everyone's laughing at me. I struggled a little bit with that one. The question of the afternoon, which Catholic moral teaching do you reject? Is there a Catholic moral teaching that you just can't get your mind around or can't bring yourself to accept? Give us a call, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. All that after this on Catholic Answers Live.